This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
When you look at the motivations of the local fighters, often they may start to desert or want to leave if their payments are not coming in. So they are partly motivated also by, you know, illicit finances or money, recruitment money coming into their hands.
That was Dino Mahatani, a senior African terrorism researcher for the International Crisis Group, who is not convinced about some Mozambican rebels' commitment to Islam. Details coming up. Also, an economic report indicates that the global pandemic has pushed more than 55 million Africans into extreme poverty. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story, calling for calm. The UN Special Advisor on Libya, Stephanie Williams, is urging rival parties to refrain from taking part in the clashes that recently erupted in the capital, Tripoli. She said the United Nations is ready to host all parties in helping Libya find a genuine, consensual way forward towards stability and elections. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the potential success of such an invitation.
Sure, it worked in 2015 and got us the Libyan political agreement, which almost worked and is still the basis of some of the existing institutions and a lot of the laws that we're using now in Libya, despite the effects of the civil war in working to undo it. It didn't entirely succeed in undoing it. It worked in terms of the Berlin process that paved the way for the ceasefire. The ceasefire has held for nearly 2 years. There's really no other way. Now, Stephanie Williams has referred to the vestiges of the 2014 parliament in the East and the vestiges of the 2012 parliament in the West as dinosaurs. And there was another statement issued today by the Council of Tribes saying they've got the answer. But you could call the Council of Tribes sort of the parents of the dinosaurs, the dinosauric fathers, you know, and these are sources of authority that no Libyans under 40 really want to be running the country. So this process is happening in Cairo yesterday, happening today, and for as many days as they can make it work. You know, peace negotiations fail until they succeed. And so they'll succeed when they reach an agreement that everyone can live with. But Williams's plan is clear. There's a political process. There's an economic process. There's a security process. It was all laid out in Berlin. She's following the roadmap. And it's really the only way forward. This won't be solved by force of arms.
Do you envision any particular compromise to end the political crisis in Libya?
Well, the short, medium, and long-term compromises. In the short term, we need to work out a deal whereby the Eastern salaries get paid and the distribution of oil proceeds get distributed fairly. They were quite upset when some money was cut off, but that was to be expected since they were trying to force the Western government out of power by arms. So it's very hard to say, I want to force you out of power by shooting at you, but also please give me some money. But if they could work out a deal in the margins of the Cairo conference to get the money flowing again to the East, that will help. If they can get a deal on elections, first the constitutional basis of elections, and then the date for elections, that will help. And then all of these other things will start falling into place, including, you know, issues around the central bank and the Libyan sovereign fund and how to demobilize the militias. I mean, there's a whole action plan coming out of Berlin with 54 points and you know, dozens of action items, but most of them are being held up by the lack of elections.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Almost 4 years into a so-called Islamic extremist insurgency in northern Mozambique, it remains unclear who its leaders are. The militants claim to be fighting to improve the lives of the poor inhabitants of Cabo Delgado province, but their insurgency has killed 3,500 people and displaced 800,000. International terrorism experts say the Mozambican jihadists are undoubtedly linked to global terror groups, but that this should not be exaggerated. Darren Taylor has more.
Terrorism analysts say Cabo Delgado inhabitants who mostly support the opposition Renamo party have been neglected by the Frelimo government for decades. They say locals also believe the state's stealing their province's natural resources and mineral wealth.
The genesis of this crisis really is a Mozambican crisis with a foreign plug-in.
Dino Matani is a senior African terrorism researcher for the International Crisis Group. He says several global jihadist organizations are exploiting the discontent in Cabo Delgado to gain a foothold in southern Africa and are arming and training the disaffected Mozambicans.
The rank and file and the majority of fighters are Mozambican. These are young men who are angry. Now, a good proportion of the senior leaders are certainly indoctrinated and are using the cloak of Islamic jihadism to present themselves as sort of millenarian warriors fighting against a corrupt state, but also trying to implement Sharia law.
For more than 3 years, the militants have attacked villages and towns, sometimes beheading people they accuse of transgressing their version of Islamic doctrine. But Matani isn't convinced that most of the rebels are dedicated to jihad or holy war.
When you look at the motivations of the local fighters, often they may start to desert or want to leave if their payments are not coming in. So they are partly motivated also by, you know, illicit finances or money, recruitment money coming into their hands.
He says it's no coincidence that the insurgency in Mozambique began shortly after authorities in neighboring Tanzania targeted Islamic extremist groups affiliated with Al-Qaeda in 2017.
These young men were expelled or cracked down upon in Tanzania. Many of them drifted into Mozambique. They brought that ideology with them. They merged and fused with the Mozambican militants, and they have played a role of moving back into Tanzania, coming back and forth for different periods of the fighting. Now with
Southern African and Rwandese troops now active across Cabo Delgado, says Matani, these Al-Qaeda trained fighters are hiding across East Africa and beyond.
It's through this sort of caucus of young men, Tanzanians but also Kenyans, that ISIS is trying to drill into, co-opt that network and bring it out of Al-Qaeda's camp into the ISIS camp, really through the dissemination of money.
Matani's information is that Kenya-based ISIS cells specializing in illicit financial flows have been bankrolling insurgents not only in Mozambique, but also in Democratic Republic of Congo, Tanzania, and Uganda. He says many East African terrorists flushed from their safe houses by security force operations in their home countries are now based in ISIS training camps in eastern DRC. From there, adds Matani, they join the fight in Mozambique.
So there's a to-ing and fro-ing of Swahili Coast boys participating in violent conflict in Cabo Delgado, but also in eastern Congo. New research that we're doing also gives more credibility to reports of Mozambicans in the past who've been trained in these camps in eastern Congo.
All of this taken together, says Matani, shows there's close cooperation between several international and multinational terror networks across Africa. They exchange intelligence, money, weapons, fighters, and much more. He says these fluid but strong alliances mean that when a particular insurgency is squashed, others are likely to emerge elsewhere. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The Zimbabwe Parks and Wildlife Management Authority, ZimParks, is lobbying Western governments to support a bid to reduce its massive ivory stockpile and trim the growing elephant population. More on the story from Bulawayo.
The appeal was made by the Parks Director Flotel Mangwanya to European Union diplomats during a recent tour of the ivory stockpile in Harare. Mangwanya appealed for their endorsement of a one-off sale of his ivory stockpile at the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species CITES meeting toward the end of the year in Panama. According to the Parks Authority, Zimbabwe's ivory stockpile is valued at over US $600 million. He said Zimbabwe felt betrayed after following conditions on the listing of its elephant population. The PAC's authorities now maintain that Zimbabwe is ahead of 100,000 elephants, which it says is more than the country can support, and needs to sell some of the ivory to fund PAC operations sustainably. Botswana has used similar arguments to justify the resumption of selling permits to hunt the coveted trophy animals. PAC spokesperson Tinashe Farao says his organization's appeal to cut the elephant population is starting to sound repetitive.
What we are simply doing is to re-engage, share our stories with the international community, share our stories with our African brothers, share our story with Europe, so that at least when it comes to vote, at least we can get numbers. The decisions that we are making, they are science-based, it's evidence-based.
Farao says moving the elephants is the costly but long-term solution other than culling, which was halted 35 years ago under international pressure. Still, while acknowledging Zimpac's sterling work in maintaining the elephant population, some conservationists say culling is out of the question, with their accounts putting Zimbabwe's elephant population between 27,000 and 40,000. Trevor Lane of the Journey Trust is among those who highlight the importance of migratory corridors between countries for elephants.
So I think it could fluctuate from, I don't know, maybe 10,000 through to 40,000 in a year. But generally the population of elephant in one year is accepted at about 30 to 40,000.
Conservationists say Zimpac's argument for selling ivory to help fund conservation purposes is potentially a good initiative, but they also worry it might fuel illegal wildlife trade. Luke Brown of the Zambezi Conservation Alliance says some of the funds could go toward helping communities on the fringes with wildlife and toward creating solutions in human-wildlife conflict.
If those funds are to genuinely be channeled into conservation for the benefit of biodiversity, to reduce habitat loss, to maintain or increase species numbers, of any animal, wild animal, then I would say yes, that value could be used.
Elephants require a vast home range, putting increasing pressure on the environment as numbers grow. For VOA News in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. The International Committee of the Red Cross says more than 10.5 million people in the four Sahel countries face malnutrition, a particularly worrisome situation as they enter the lean season between harvests when food is mostly depleted. Mavis Ochera in Juwaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana has more on the story.
Tariq Webi, the spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in the Sahel, says the food crisis is the result of multiple convergent factors, including conflict. He says the four countries, Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, and Mauritania, also are battling climate change as temperatures in the Sahel are rising faster than anywhere in the world.
The region is going through one of its most severe droughts in over a decade. So food production has dropped by as much as 40%, for example, in Niger and in Mauritania. On the other hand, we have conflict, and conflict is severely aggravating the situation and fueling this crisis.
He says more than 2 million people have been internally displaced across the region due to conflict, with 70% in Burkina Faso, accounting for almost 10% of the country's population. Webby says 80% of the Sahel residents are dependent on agriculture for their survival, leaving them without resources when they flee their homes.
They can no longer harvest their crops. They can no longer migrate their animals through the usual transhumance routes. And effectively, once displaced, they immediately become food insecure and they become extremely vulnerable. At the same time, there are populations that are in areas that are very hard to access for humanitarian organizations. There are even populations that are practically under siege in certain places. And these people are going through this food crisis on their own, without any assistance.
He says Parts of Burkina Faso also are suffering a water crisis with waits of up to 72 hours to access water in some areas. He says the Red Cross is scaling up its response across the region and is collaborating with Red Cross and Red Crescent movement to meet the needs of most vulnerable while seeking long-term solutions.
We are also getting together with multiple actors from governments to development actors in order to find longer-term solutions, because simply thinking in terms of emergency will keep us stuck in a cycle where people are reliant on aid and we will see the same things happen again.
He cited a need for investment in new and innovative solutions. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Drassu in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
Nigeria's anti-graft agency says it has arrested the country's accountant general, Ahmed Idris, for allegedly diverting $193 million in public funds. The Economic and Financial Crimes Commission said in a statement that it earlier invited Idris to come in to answer questions, but he refused. Dr. Abubakar Sani is a public affairs analyst based in Maiduguri in northeastern Nigeria. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye about the arrest and Nigeria's anti-corruption war. He says the scope of anti-corruption investigation should be widened to cover states and local governments.
I received that very news, just like many other Nigerians, with a rude shock. Because if the nation's custodian of our financial resources, the number one treasurer of the nation, will be caught, you know, amassing, hiding, laundering money to the tune of $80 billion, then it means this fight against corruption is just a ruse. We're not really doing anything. How come this man has been able to, siphon, launder this very money? And for all these years that he has been AG, they've not been able to detect it.
So one of the mantles the government used to come to power was that it's going to fight corruption. What's your assessment of the government's fight against corruption?
Honestly, if I would grade the government as a teacher, I would give them a grade D. Understand? I would give them a grade D. Because if the nation's accountant general, caught embezzling, laundering $80 billion, it means there are many others who have done similar things. And it's a miracle that the economy of the country has not even collapsed. And we keep on borrowing money from World Bank, IMF, Islamic Development Bank, in the name of executing infrastructural development and so on and so forth. At the end, it got diverted into private pockets. Understand? So our major problem now we are battling with ASU. Understand? That is ASU. The minimum wage is just 30,000 naira. What can it earn in the market? The problem is not even ASU that government should not pay them. The problem is mismanagement. That's Joseph. This government has scored low on the indices of managing resources. Fiscal discipline is low.
Do you think Nigeria's an anti-graft agency called the Economics and Financial Crimes Commission should widen its scope with a view to arresting more of such high-ranking officials or doing more of investigation to get to arrest more people in the mold of the Accountant General of the Federation?
Of course, if money to the tune of 80 billion naira will be siphoned, and then we have a sitting auditor general of the Federation, yet he was unable to detect this, that it means he is, to my mind, maybe a collaborator. So many people are aware of this very scam and they cover it because they also benefited from it. And for your question, let me respond directly that, should we widen the scope? My answer is an absolute yes. We should take this thing not just to the federal government structure, but including state and especially local government. Local government are receiving nothing less than 200. I think 20 or 50 million naira monthly. Where is the money going to? You understand? They should widen their scope, deepen it to state and local government. And for once and for all, let's people know that there is a deterrence mechanism. Some of these things, if the EFCC and the legal department, that's the judiciary, are not you know, it's taking a strong measure to deal with those who are, you know, embezzling government money, it will not serve as a deterrence mechanism to others. But if they can make a public example with this accountant general and so many others that are involved, people like you and I and others will say, no, this is not the way to go about it. Even if it is not for the fear of God, there are consequences.
That was public affairs analyst Aboubakar Sani speaking by phone with reporter Mike Imbonye. The global pandemic has pushed more than 55 million Africans into extreme poverty and reversed two decades of hard work in poverty reduction on the continent. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
In a 134-page report launched in Dakar, Senegal, the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa said the coronavirus negatively impacted the continent's economy. Speaking Saturday at the 54th session of the Conference of African Ministers of Finance, Planning and Economic Development, Hanan Morsi, Deputy Executive Secretary of the Commission, said the pandemic eliminated 20 years' worth of achievements made in fighting poverty.
It's really of particular relevance given what we have seen during the pandemic and the implication for the continent. One of the most critical implications of COVID-19 has been the reversal of very hard-won gains that the continent has managed to achieve in terms of reducing poverty. So we've lost almost two decades of hard-won gains of reducing poverty in Africa due to the pandemic.
The economic decline caused by the lockdowns and the restrictions on people and the movement of goods has increased the number of newly poor on the continent by 55 million people and pushed 39 million others into extreme poverty. Morsi says millions of people are still vulnerable.
On top of that all, between 30 million and 35 million formal jobs are at risk of reductions in wages and working hours because of reduced demand and enforced lockdowns. The current reality is that fiscal deficits and debts have worsened, gender inequalities remain significant and have been accumulated during the pandemic. Even worse, economic growth in both developed and developing economies are expected to decelerate in 2023.
The report also documents job losses, people earning less, and the inability to manage the risk, making them more vulnerable. African governments have responded to the economic crisis by expanding their fiscal and monetary policies. Ken Gishenga is the chief executive at Mentoria Economics. He says Africa needs policies that can bring money to people.
We need to really look at the foundational areas of food production, agriculture. Then now we need to build the industrial value addition and the services. So we'll need strong fiscal policies and strong monetary policy. But most importantly, we need policies that encourage business, policies that encourage enterprise, which means things like VAT, taxation. Those things need to be reduced so that we have money in the pockets of people and so that there is demand for goods and services.
The Economic Commission researchers say the African Continental Free Trade Area can give countries opportunity to diversify their economies and reduce dependence on external partners and trade with each other more. Gishenga says African countries need to produce more goods to fashion economic growth.
We need to get these countries into production. They need to start producing because what has happened during the pandemic is production has dropped, and because of that, there has been a drop in problem, not only productivity, but in jobs and in wages. So being able to bring all the 54 countries back into production, that can really stimulate the African economy and create jobs.
Economic experts are calling on African governments to create programs for social protection and provide short-term assistance to the most vulnerable communities. Africa is also encouraged to invest in health protection systems and create a policy for national health emergencies that can stand against future pandemics. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Audrius Regas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.